Good afternoon and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 6th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, Mavis Anderson continues her study on Cuba, Neither Heaven Nor Hell. Today's topic is entitled U.S.-Cuba Relations, Realities and Prospects. This is session ANM 2000-3. Let's listen in.
People may just decide to stay out in the nice warm sun. But let's start. The session today on Cuba is going to focus on legislation. So it's a session about what has happened between the two countries, between the U.S. and Cuba, legislatively, policy-wise. What's happening right now, and it's a very fluid time, and what are some prospects in the future that may impact U.S. policy on Cuba. Before we start on some of the content, I want to point out a couple of things. There's all sorts of material here, and those of you who've been in the sessions on Cuba before have seen all of this before. It's all the same stuff, but if you haven't taken a look at it, there's some things that you might find of interest. There are a couple of good summary sheets just on an analysis of policy over on this side, and this is material from the Latin America Working Group, which is a public policy education advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. And on the other side here, it's a more education-focused from the Center for Global Education based at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And what we do is provide international experiences, study trips to many different countries, one of them being Cuba. I do have some sign-up sheets. The one that's going to be on this side is if you want to be on the mailing list of the Center for Global Education, and just see what sorts of study opportunities there are. So sign up on that one. And on the other side, there's another sign-up sheet. I have an email distribution list, which I send out not a lot, so you don't, I don't flood your inboxes. But I send out occasional updates and alerts on Cuba legislation. And that's, gives guidelines for what you as a constituent can do to impact how your congressperson votes on Cuba legislation. And for that one, I need an email address. So I just encourage you to take a look at those. And there's some magazines and organizing packets and what here, whatever, and even some videos, and they're all free for the taking. I'm going to base what I say today on my work with the Latin America Working Group, so I just want to tell you a couple words about who we are. It's a coalition of churches, multi-denominational, including some Jewish organizations, human rights groups, development groups, humanitarian aid organizations that are nationally based throughout the country. There are about 60 organizations that come together in a coalition with the Latin America Working Group. And what we do is trace U.S. policy on Latin America, try to impact it so that it becomes a more just and sustainable kind of policy. And my work there with the working group focuses on Cuba. So for the past few years, I have been tracing U.S.-Cuba policy and trying to see even some little tiny changes, which at times were very hard to see. But this is quite a fluid time right now with a lot of forces coming together to, many of us think, provide the opportunity for some change. So I do want to just very, very briefly trace some of the major events in U.S. policy toward Cuba before we talk about what's happening today. Very, very quickly after Castro's revolution was successful in 1959, very quickly the United States and Cuba came to loggerheads over a number of different issues. And I've traced those in previous sections, so I won't go into that. But in 1961 was the beginning of the embargo, the U.S. embargo against Cuba. and it has progressively tightened since that time. It started out just as a partial embargo on a few products, and very quickly by 62, it was broadened to be a total trade embargo. So there, it is illegal for U.S. companies to trade at all with Cuba. And that's been since 1962. There have been sort of a few ups and downs in the middle of that. There are times when the administration that's in power has an inclination to loosen things up, and sometimes they allow a little bit more travel. Sometimes some licenses are granted for various sales of foods or of medicine. But all in all, it has progressively tightened from 61 until the present day. And the two most recent important events or pieces of legislation were in 1992 and in 1996. In 92, there was a bill passed that's called the Cuba Democracy Act. And it was introduced by then Representative Torricelli in the House of Representatives, and was also then passed by the Senate. And it's the most stringent probably complete list of restrictions in our arsenal of restrictions. What it did was, prior to 92, companies in the United States could sell through their subsidiary in a third country to Cuba, so that even though they couldn't directly deal from their U.S. base with Cuba, they could deal through, if they had a European subsidiary, that subsidiary could trade with Cuba. And in 92, that possibility was cut off. We also wrote into that law that our allies, such as Canada or Britain or Spain or wherever, European countries, who have been trading with Cuba regularly, we started sanctioning our allies for trading with Cuba. For example, if, say, France, who sells food to Cuba, shipped something from France to Cuba via ship. The ship docks in Cuba, and that from that moment on, for 180 days, that particular ship cannot dock in the United States. So there's some real, people who want to trade with Cuba really have to be committed to trading with Cuba, because they bring U.S. sanctions upon themselves by doing that. The other thing that the 92 legislation did was that it put into place something called Track 2, which is very offensive to the Cubans, because it started talking about people-to-people contacts, U.S. people with Cuban people, but for the purpose of overthrowing their government. So we want them to have contact with us, so that they'll learn how much better our system is than theirs, and they'll rise up and overthrow the Cuban government. And that's an extremely offensive thing to Cuba, as you might guess. Come be our friends so we can overthrow your government. And it's hard even for those of us who promote also people-to-people contacts to kind of interpret our motivations to our Cuban friends, that no, that's not the reason we're coming here, you know, to visit your country and to learn to know something about your people. Our motivations are different from those of our government. So those were the major things in the Cuban Democracy Act. And it just was an increase in economic pressure. And actually, the other thing that's really important about that particular piece of legislation is the timing of it. You remember that the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc dissolved 89-90, really completely in 91. This piece of legislation was passed in 92. These were the most difficult years for Cuba economically, as it was trying to survive the loss of 85% of its trade almost overnight, And they were having a terrible time between 89 and 93, 94. And this piece of legislation, which just squeezed far further and further on the Cuban economy, was done specifically at that time and for that purpose, because Cuba was already having a difficult time. And we thought, the U.S. government thought, that putting this additional pressure on them might actually cause the overthrow of Castro.
Was that Bush or Clinton?
That was Clinton. Is that right? Just let me think. 96. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was Clinton. And actually, Clinton, even to today, says that he felt and still feels that that piece of legislation was a correct policy. And just talking about the Clinton administration, if Vice President Gore is elected, it's a step backward, actually, in terms of Cuba policy, because he's very strongly opposed to changing U.S.-Cuba policy. So Bush, Gore on Cuba, it's sort of a toss-up on that particular issue. Well, Clinton did have some inclinations, actually, in 94, 95, because the legislation in 92, the Cuban Democracy Act, left some flexibility for the administration, for the president, by executive order to change some things about the embargo. The executive order could allow for granting of licenses, it could change the definition of who can travel to Cuba, and that sort of thing. So there was an inclination on the president's part in 94-95 to loosen it a bit. And Senator Jesse Helms from North Carolina, who has been kind of Cuba's nemesis for the whole 40 years, decided to introduce a piece of legislation that would disallow that, and it would take away from the president almost all of his powers to loosen the embargo. And this piece of legislation got stalled in the Senate because there was a great debate as to whether or not that was a good idea. It had another provision in it that not only disallows subsidiary trade and gives a strong message to our allies, don't trade with Cuba, but it gave U.S. citizens and U.S. companies the authority to sue foreign companies, foreign individuals, foreign governments, if they invested in Cuba and their investment had anything to do with a piece of property that had been expropriated by the Cuban government and used to be owned by the U.S. So if you had, say, a Exxon who owned a refinery in Cuba, which got expropriated, and somebody from Spain invested in that refinery to help Cuba refine crude oil, Exxon could sue the foreign country or company for investing in previously owned U.S. property. Our allies just went crazy about this. You know, they said this is an issue of intervention in our own foreign policy, telling us who we can trade with. It's just against international law. What happened was it got written into this piece of law that the president can waive it. This is called Title III. And the president can waive this, and he's done that for every six months since the bill was passed. Well, I'm jumping ahead of myself because it got stalled in the Senate. And in the meantime, unfortunately, does anybody remember what happened in February of 96, a major incident between Cuba and the U.S.?
There was a flight from Florida over to Cuba, and I don't know exactly what the motivation of the flight was, but it was shot down.
Yeah. There's a group
by the Cuban Air Force.
Right, exactly. There were two planes from Brothers to the Rescue, which is a Cuban-American group in Miami that throws leaflets you know, dumps leaflets out in Cuba and goes, and they still do this, they fly out right up to Cuban airspace and watch for boat people who are leaving Cuba, and they either pick them up or get help for them or whatever. They're a very unfriendly group to Castro, obviously, and Cuba maintains that two of these planes violated their airspace and they were shot down in February of 96, which at that point caused the Jesse Helms bill to be passed. The president had previously said he wouldn't sign it if it passed, but once these two planes were shot down, and I think four people were killed, the Senate and the House quickly passed the legislation. The president signed it, and in signing it, the president took away from himself a lot of his authority in making policy toward Cuba. So right now we've got an embargo that's been codified, and that means it's law, and the only way that it can be changed is for Congress again to pass an act that will reverse those decisions. That's kind of where we are right at this moment. All of those strong restrictions are still in place. And some interesting things have happened. The United States stands alone in its policy toward Cuba. There's no other country in the world, even our closest allies, who support us in this. Occasionally, Israel will vote with us in the UN, but interestingly enough, Israel trades with Cuba. Israel invests in Cuba. Israel has diplomatic relationships with Cuba. They'll support us in the UN, but they don't buy into the Helms-Burton law. And U.S. policy simply just hasn't succeeded. Whatever its goals are, if it's to overthrow Castro, it hasn't succeeded. If it's to make the Cuban people rise up against their government because we've made it so miserable for them, it hasn't succeeded. And interestingly enough, people in the Congress who for years have supported this policy are seeing the light and saying, why don't we try something different? This just isn't working. So a lot of the churches and a lot of the humanitarian aid groups such as Oxfam America, American Friends Service Committee, have been working for years to find ways to convince the Congress that this policy is counterproductive. And many things have happened in the last year that have kind of helped this along. Does anybody have ideas? What's happened in public opinion, in public consciousness about Cuba that might have some impact on our policy?
Elian.
Elian, absolutely. Elian Gonzalez brought Cuba to our newspapers, to our TV shows, to our radio shows, to coffee shops across the country. You say the word Elian and everybody knows what you're talking about. So that humanized the struggle between the two countries, I think. That's one thing. What else do you think may bring this issue to a head?
The farm crisis, I think.
Definitely. Our farmers are in need of markets. Their crops are, you know, there's no place to sell them, the prices are not good, they need new markets. So you find legislators in the farm states, in upper Midwest, in the center, middle part of the country, Missouri, Kansas, people are dying for markets. And so legislators who previously to this would not have thought about Cuba are realizing that there's a market here to be had for their farmers. And estimates vary. It's really hard to know. Cuba's not a wealthy country. It doesn't have big stashes of cash that are just sitting there available to purchase goods, but they have to buy food. Last year they imported $750 million worth of food. They imported it from rice from China and Vietnam. When our Louisiana farmers who grow rice have no markets for their rice and are very much supporting a change in policy that would allow them to sell rice to Cuba. Some analysts say that within 5 years, the Cuban market could amount to $5 billion. I think that's probably a little excessive. But the point is, there are markets to be had. We have products to sell. And it's changed some of our senators' and representatives' minds about Cuba. What else do you think may have brought this issue of our relationships to Cuba?
Election year.
And how does that do it?
Well, the way the candidates speak up for or against mm-hmm. the embargo could change people's attitude mm-hmm. towards Honduras. Mm-hmm.
What's happening with public opinion in this country about Cuba? What do your fellow U.S. citizens say about Cuba? Do they want to keep the embargo? Have you heard anything about this? There's a Gallup poll that was taken, I think, in February of 99. I think that's when. 71% of the U.S. public wants to end the embargo of Cuba, wants to resume diplomatic relations. And it's taking our legislators a while to hear this word, but they're beginning to hear it. And their constituents are making their voices known. And the election year is a very important year because in some of the key states where there are farm markets, those, and they happen to be Republicans, are up for re-election, and they are being definitely challenged. For example, Senator Ashcroft from Missouri, conservative Republican, just, you know, someone that you wouldn't expect to take up the mantle of Cuba policy, is leading the pack because he's got a strong challenger. He needs a win in Congress to take back to his constituents to say, vote for me, look what I'm doing for our farmers. He's just really stepped up to the plate on Cuba policy. Another person is Representative Nethercutt from the state of Washington, who is facing the same thing. He came into the House in 92 when there was this big turnover and the Democrats lost the majority, the Republicans, and Newt Gingrich, you know, rose to the majority in the House. Well, Representative Nethercutt, who represents Spokane and surrounding areas, there are issues of grain, apples, I don't remember the other crops, but there are quite a few agricultural commodities that are also looking for markets. He is just running neck and neck with his challenger. Same thing. He needs a win. And he needs his name in the paper, and he needs his constituents to know that he's working for them. He, in the House, is leading the pack on changing Cuba policy in terms of selling farm goods to Cuba. So that's another important one. We've got Elian, we've got the farm crisis, we've got elections.
The Pope visited.
Yeah. Yep. 98. January 98. The Pope kind of gave permission to people to go find out what's happening in Cuba. And it opened the floodgates for people who want to go visit Cuba. And it also gave some legitimacy to calls to an end for the embargo because the Pope criticized the embargo. So there's another one. There's one more big one.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I don't know if this is a big one, but how about the fact that there's more and more Hispanic voters in this country?
Yeah, that's not the one I'm thinking of, but that definitely is true too. There are more Hispanic voters. They're sympathetic to their fellow Latin Americans. They're Cubans. Now, obviously, you all know that there's a major population. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I'm wondering if it's China being voted into the World yep. Trade, and then when you say we are open to China,
yep.
but then...
Yep. That's it. That's a major one. We just passed in the House, a bill that is giving China permanent normal trade relations with the U.S. China's communist. China has human rights problems. Anything that you can criticize Cuba about in terms of its human rights policy, its repression of dissidents, you can say the same thing about China, but you multiply it quite a many-fold. So if China, why not Cuba? Those four or five things have really brought this issue to our consciousness, and I think especially Elian has brought it to our hearts. And believe it or not, congressional people have hearts also, and I think they're feeling the need to do something.
No, there's one other one. And
yes.
I mean, there are a number of other communist systems throughout the world that failed without embargoes. So it would seem like people would just see, well, what's the point? I mean,
mm-hmm.
the system is eventually going to fail anyway. It's not going to endure forever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
So why not?
Yeah, you've got, let's see, who's failed? The Soviet Union obviously has collapsed. Who else has failed?
Well, most everything in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Collapsed.
Yeah, the Eastern Bloc.
Vietnam is looking less and less communist.
True, and we also trade with Vietnam. And Vietnam, and those of you who have been in any of my other sessions have heard me say this before, but Vietnam was a place where 54,000 U.S. lives were lost. We were involved in a prolonged war. In addition, some 3 million Vietnamese lost their lives. And yet, we trade with them. We have relations with them. The president has given orders to open up more and more to them. The same with North Korea. Just within the last weeks, there's been a presidential order that allows more trade with North Korea. So why Cuba? Why Cuba? And people can't answer that. Yes?
I think it's the Cuban-American lobby.
Uh-huh.
Right? And their power and their influence over within the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. And what did Elian do to that?
It turned, I never had any much sympathy for them anyway, but it seems like it turned sympathy and support against
away
them.
Away from them. Mm-hmm.
Because it made America, notice, I don't know, the policies, the feelings towards Cuba that for the rest of America seemed unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, when they were, just to illustrate my point, when the supposedly stormtroopers broke in and stole Elian at gunpoint and whisked him off, they were outraged. How could that happen in America? Well, that happens to Mexican people all the time.
Yeah.
It's not even for us. They're being treated like the rest of us, finally.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, this can't happen in America. Well, this does happen in America,
mm-hmm.
and it happens to a lot of Americans,
mm-hmm.
not only Mexican Americans, but white Americans too. That's the kind of system we live under.
Mm-hmm. There was an interesting comparison that was made with Haiti, because in Miami there are also a lot of Haitian refugees, and Haitian boat people still coming to our shores. We've got a policy with Cuba. It's called wet foot, dry foot. So if a Cuban boat person gets to the shore and actually puts his or her foot on U.S. soil, that person is allowed to stay. If that person is interdicted, 10 feet out into the ocean, they will be sent back. That's the agreement that we have with Cuba, and in return for that policy, we allow up to 20,000 Cuban immigrants to our country each year. It's very different with Haiti. And it's not just adults, it's children too. And there was an amazing comparison between a couple of Haitian children who came here on a boat with their mother. Their mother was with them. Their mother was ill in a hospital in Miami. The two Haitian children were sent back to Haiti. Their mother was here. They were sent back. And then you've got Elian, who's got a father who wants him back, and he's detained to go through our legal system. So those things were not lost on the American public in terms of...
Yes. Another issue, too, was the fact that obviously Haitians are black. Mm-hmm. There are black Cubans, but this particular Cuban was not black. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there, and therefore was exploited even more as a symbol. It's the Ricky Martin syndrome. You know, as long as Latinos, you know, they'll love us and accept us and go crazy as long as we look like Ricky Martin and even change our name to Ricky Martin. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, America doesn't want us.
Yeah. Valid points. So, we've got Cuba. We've got people aware that our policy's not working. We're finally beginning to see Cubans as people who get hungry, and we don't sell them food. People who need medicines, and their pharmacies are empty. I was there, I think this happened in June 98. I was with a group of students, and several of our young people weren't feeling very well. It wasn't anything serious, but they had stomach upset, and we needed some meds. So we were outside of Havana in the town of Matanzas, which is just a couple hours down the north coast from Havana, smaller town. And one of our Cuban hosts took us to a pharmacy to buy some meds for these two young women. I went in this pharmacy and I could not believe it. You know, it was a room probably a quarter of the size of this room with shelves around the wall. Nothing. There was nothing on the shelf. There was no antidiarrheal. There was no aspirin. There was nothing. Nothing. You know, there we were. We were going to pay in dollars. You know, it wasn't even that we were paying in pesos. There was nothing to buy. So our Cuban host took us down the street to a natural medicine store, and we bought in Cuban pesos a few little bottles of some sort of elixirs that they told us what they were made of. I don't remember now. And maybe that's one good side effect of this embargo, is that the Cubans are wonderfully creative and are recovering some of their natural medicines and some of their organic farming methods, and hopefully once the embargo is ended, they'll keep those recovered pieces of knowledge too. So I want to talk a little bit about what's happening now in the Congress, that the embargo is in place, it's alive and well, but all these things are kind of fomenting right now under the surface. And there's been in both the Senate and the House for the last year and a half a couple of bills that would lift the restrictions on the sale of food and medicine to Cuba. There's a bill in the Senate that was sponsored by Senator Dodd from Connecticut and Senator Warner, who's a Republican from Virginia, that would lift the sanction. And that bill is S-926. And it has 27 co-sponsors right now, which is not enough. You know, you gotta have 50 in order for it to pass. But a co-sponsor kind of guarantees their vote to this piece of legislation, and then other people who don't co-sponsor it certainly would still vote for it. But at least what that piece of legislation does is gives us a barometer or a marker in the Senate to know where our level of support is. However, that piece of legislation has to go through the Foreign Relations Committee, which is controlled by Jesse Helms, and so it never reaches the floor. So we don't know, you know, what would happen if that reached the floor. Similar situation in the House. There's a House bill on food and medicine. In fact, it's the same language as the Senate bill. It would lift all restrictions on selling food and medicine to Cuba. It's H.R. 1644. It was introduced by Representative Serrano from New York and Leach from Iowa. There are 167 co-sponsors. To pass a bill in the House, you need 212 votes. So again, we've got a good chunk of people, good indication that this bill would do pretty well if it got to the House floor. But it won't be brought to the floor because the Republican leadership in the House refuses to let us have a debate on the floor and to take a vote on this bill. So those are Cuba specific. But now, like I said, enter the farm crisis, and you've got Representative Nethercutt from here in Washington and Senator Ashcroft from Missouri, who have both introduced bills that would lift sanctions on food and medicine for all countries who are currently on the U.S. terrorist list. This includes Cuba, Libya, North Korea, Sudan, and Iran. Those five countries. A lot of markets here. The farmers are very interested in these. Iran is a very large market. So these pieces of legislation have actually been moving, and part of it is this election issue. These people need help from the leadership to win their elections, so they're getting some attention. And the most interesting part of it happened in the House just over the last couple of months. The way the process happens is Representative Nethercutt took this language, this bill, and offered it as an amendment to the Agricultural Appropriations Bill. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details because it all gets very convoluted, but I want to tell you enough so that you see where the blockages are. It passed in the subcommittee, which is good. That's the first step. He had the bill. He took it to the subcommittee, the agricultural subcommittee of the appropriations bill. It passed. Then it goes to the full committee, the full appropriations committee. It's still the ag bill, but it has to pass the full appropriations committee. And the appropriations bills are spending bills. They tell you how much you can spend on whatever. This piece of legislation isn't a spending legislation. So technically, it's out of order. It's not appropriating any money to do anything, but it's a vehicle to get this language in front of the Congress. This happens all the time. In fact, the appropriations bill this year has got, I think, 67 amendments to it that are really out of order. They don't fit there, but it works, and they allow it to happen. So this bill now comes to the full committee. It's got good support, good debate, a lot of people talking in favor of it. Representative DeLay, who is the Republican whip in the House, in the Republican leadership, proposes an amendment to strike it. He wants the whole thing gone. He loses. He was surprised. He didn't expect to lose. He lost pretty big, actually, in appropriations. He lost by 10 votes. I was at this hearing, and he stomped out of the room. He was not a happy man. This is good. It's passed two hurdles, passed subcommittee, passed committee. It's got good support in the House in general. The predictions are that if it would reach the House floor, it would pass. This is good news. We've got, you know, more than 220 representatives who would vote for this bill. It's not going to happen. And actually, you know, I just flashing back to the last session in here where we saw the video on the gay and lesbian ministries in San Francisco and in Iowa. Ruth Frost was talking about this, how it was an attack on identity, and it was the not accepting them into the church as full partners in ministry and through ordination. She felt as you know, the word she used was a violation. It's an abuse of power. This is what the people want, and in her opinion, the hierarchy wasn't allowing that to happen. That's exactly what I see happening in Congress right now. If this bill would get to the floor, it would pass. 71% of the American public want it to pass. The subcommittees, the committees, want it to pass. There are about five people in our Congress who can block this piece of legislation, and it's, in my opinion, it's an abuse of power. You've got the Republican leadership, and you've got three Cuban-American representatives who wield a great deal of power. And through backroom maneuvering, they're keeping this piece of legislation from reaching the floor of the House, from letting the democratic process happen and pass this legislation. To me, it's just an abomination. And I, you know, what do you do? You're kind of, eventually it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen this year. So just before I came out here, actually 2 days before we left home, a backroom deal happened with Representative Nethercutt, who is the sponsor of the legislation. They had a, you know, middle of the night meeting. I think the meeting started at 10 at night and it went till 2 in the morning. And five people came up with a deal on his piece of legislation that would pass the floor if it got there. And what they did was they said that there could be no imports from Cuba. This is what they agreed, and this is now what the language reads. There would be no imports from Cuba to the United States. Okay, that's not so serious. That, you know, would come eventually. They said that all sales of food and medicine would need to be licensed. That's sort of where we are now, so that's no big gain, you know, and no loss. It's kind of even. But there were two really big compromises that Nethercutt was forced to make. One is that there would be no credits available for sales. So it's a cash-on-delivery basis that sales would happen. Cuba's not sitting there, like I said, with big piles of money in order to purchase this food and medicine. So that's going to severely limit the number of sales. And further than that, you know, what Nethercutt was wanting to do is benefit the farmers. It's not going to happen. It's going to benefit Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill, probably, the big multinationals who can arrange for third country financing. They can go to Canada or they can go to Mexico. They can arrange with a bank in Mexico to loan money to Cuba to buy this grain. Your small producers, your co-ops, they don't have that kind of access to credit. So it's not going to help the people it was intended to help in this country. And it's not going to help the Cubans because there are going to be very few sales that will result from it. So that's a big downside. And the second thing is that Nethercutt agreed to write into his bill that the president no longer will have any authority to make any decisions as to who can travel to Cuba. So it's a major step backwards for the travel issue. This is what's going to get passed very likely in this bill, but it's not even going to get voted on. Instead of bringing it to the House floor so it'll be voted on by your representatives and mine, except I live in D.C., so I don't have any, they're going to bring it to the conference committee. When the House passes a bill and the Senate passes a bill, they're usually not identical. They go into conference. They negotiate out their differences, they send it back to both bodies, and then it's an up and down vote. There's no debate on it. So they're going to bring this backroom deal into a conference committee. It'll probably pass, and then they'll send it back to the House, and it's an up or down vote, and it's very unlikely that the House or the Senate will say, no, we'll vote down this whole ag bill because we don't like the Cuba provisions. So my point is, is that sometimes democracy in a democratic country doesn't work the way you think it should. So that's where we are with legislation right now.
Once it gets to the floor, yeah. Can somebody not then put an amendment?
No. After it's come out of conference, it's you vote for it or you vote against it. There's no debate. There are no amendments. Yeah.
You could still get vetoed, though, too.
It could still get vetoed, yes. And that's a possibility. But again, there are going to be things in this bill that Clinton really wants. I mean, this is a big bill. This is a multi-billion dollar bill. And the likelihood that he would veto it on the fact that they're taking away from him his licensing power on travel to Cuba, I think is somewhat unlikely.
How will licensing occur?
Licensing, okay. Licensing happens through the Department of the Treasury, which is interesting. But licensing for travel is an issue for the Treasury. The restriction on travel to Cuba isn't that we can't travel to Cuba. It's that we can't spend U.S. dollars to travel to Cuba. So for a U.S. citizen, with about five exceptions, to travel to Cuba, you have to go to the Department of the Treasury Office of Foreign Assets Control and apply for a license to be able to spend U.S. dollars in Cuba. So the licensing will happen through the Treasury Department. Yes?
I had a question. You said that Cuba doesn't have any cash. Mm-hmm. But isn't that true that Castro puts away the check he gets for the rent for Guantanamo
Bay? That's true. Well, I don't know.
Collected that rent and never cashed those Treasury checks.
Yeah.
Well, what? Actually, I understand he doesn't accept those.
He doesn't cash them. We send him a check every year for, I don't know what it is, but a lot of money for Guantanamo Bay. Castro, you know, if it's a real check, I mean, symbolically, he tears it up. He doesn't accept the money. So he does not have that money there. And that's a matter of principle for Cuba because they feel the U.S. has no right to be on Guantanamo Bay, and so they don't accept rent, which would then legitimize the naval base there. Cuba, I mean, they have some money. I think I just read that they bought, I think it was rice from North Korea. No, I don't know where. But anyhow, they bought something and they did pay something with cash. So there, some sales happen with cash, but certainly not a whole lot. Yes?
I thought Cuba has cigars, sugar, and molasses.
Mm-hmm. Which is made into rum.
That's what they use for negotiating with Russia.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
But Russia got tired of sugar and they ran out of money.
Russia collapsed.
I don't think does Cuba have anything else to sell? If we get into this, are we going to have to give them a sack of money so they can buy?
Well, part of this bill is that we won't accept any products from them. They cannot export to us.
Whether you give money to them or you give it to our farmers
right.
to help them sell the Cuba because they're broke,
yeah.
I don't know about that.
Their economy is based on sugar. And the last probably about 10 years have been very difficult because the sugar harvest has been down. They don't have petroleum to run their mechanized equipment, so now their sugar harvest is back to doing it by hand. World prices are bad. They're trying to build up their markets. They sold most of their sugar to the Soviet Union, which is gone. So they're building their markets back up, and they're also trying to build their production back up. Their sugar, foreign exchange from sugar is much below what they need it to be. They have some other things that they export, but sugar's their main export crop. But they're a poor country. Mm-hmm. They're a very poor country.
I don't know. If I run out of money, I could spend it.
Yeah, but what do you do if you need food to eat?
Quit, you know, maybe don't raise sugar cane, raise vegetables.
Yeah. That's one thing they're doing actually. They have wonderful raised bed organic gardens that they've got spread now throughout the country, so there are a lot of efforts. They have a lot of problems.
Now, would they very well might buy medicines from other countries in the world?
They do.
Because they're probably more efficient than ours as far as price.
Well, they can't buy from us.
Well, that's right. Even if they could, we probably couldn't sell it because we'd be too high priced.
Actually, it's the other way around because the transportation costs from other countries in the world is so much higher than it would be from the U.S. that their natural market and their cheapest market would be here.
Oh, okay.
So, yes.
I think you maybe have touched on the tourism as a new source of revenue.
Right.
It's really important.
Yep. And actually, we talked about that quite a lot yesterday. Tourism is becoming a big market. Cuba's having to look at new ways to get foreign currency, and tourism is one of them. They're developing their beaches. There's a hotel industry. It's up and coming. The Spanish, the Canadians, other European countries, Japan, send a lot of tourists to Cuba, and it's an up-and-coming industry, and they will intend, or they're intending to make that even a more important industry. But we talked about yesterday also that there's some downsides of that for Cuba. Cuba is a socialist state, a controlled economy. Bringing in tourism and bringing in foreign investments brings some things into their country that they have been without for a number of years, such as prostitution, drugs, begging in the streets. And the thing that probably is the most difficult thing about promoting tourism is that in a state where they've been working for equality, what happens when you bring dollars into a country through a tourist economy? Who gets the dollars? What happens to the equality in your country? People who work in the tourist business, such as maids cleaning hotels, taxi drivers who take people with dollars around, they get tips in U.S. dollars, and instead of being on the same basic level with the rest of the population, all of a sudden you've got a society that again is seeing a difference in terms of wealthy and poor people. Those people with access to dollars now are the sort of emerging middle class in Cuba, where those people who have no dollars are struggling. They have subsidies for their food and some of their basic needs, but it barely reaches. Carmen?
Well, the question that I have is like, if embargo has not helped bring the system down, the system seems to be the most humanitarian system we have, at least in the Americas, because the people are being fed and they're being educated, and there is good health system, which we don't have in other countries like Brazil or Mexico. So what is about Fidel? What is it about him that keeps America so, almost like phobia? There's a Fidel phobia.
What do you think? What is it about Fidel?
Is it I'd say that the hate that motivates the Cuban Americans. I mean, this whole thing with Elliot just showed me, I mean, that it wasn't about a love for this little boy, it was about a hate working there. That's all I saw, was hatred against Fidel. No true compassion, no love, no brotherhood, no nothing, just that. Is that what it is? Is that answering that question, you think?
I think it's a generational thing, too. I think the generation that dealt with the fear of communism in the 50s and 40s those are the people who still have a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you talk to a lot of younger people, 20s and 30s, they have no fear of Cuba, they have no fear of communism, but they don't have any power other than through the vote to try to change it.
Mm-hmm. I think both of those reasons are true. There's certainly a vestige of the Cold War here, and I think the fact that Cuba is so near to us is part of that. People remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, though the Department of Defense, the U.S. Department of Defense, just did a study about a year and a half ago and concluded that there's no defense issue regarding Cuba. They're not a threat to us militarily. That's not a big surprise, but that's what the Defense Department said. And I think what you're talking about, Zarco, is it's just an irrationality, and there are probably some issues of race here, but it's propaganda that the Cuban American community in Miami has very effectively used in Congress and I think in the public, but I think that's starting to break down.
I think it's numbers ultimately. Florida is a key state in presidential elections.
But the Cuban American community is in basically Miami, one district in Florida. One half of 1% of the voters in Florida are Cuban Americans.
But of people who vote, what percent of them?
That's a good point.
In a presidential election,
Cuban Americans vote.
And a winner take all electoral college.
Yep.
Doesn't matter how many people vote. Do you have the majority? And that is a population that has a very clear ideological stance.
Yeah.
And neither party wants to lose more than they need to.
Yeah, and that's very clear, I think, in Vice President Gore's actions.
I mean, he's not going to get the majority of those voters, but I'm sure he knows he has polls that have told him how many he has to get, what percentage of that percentage, in order to win the amount that he needs to be able to have a chance of carrying Florida, which if he doesn't carry, I mean, nobody's won, I think, a presidential election without Florida.
In
the last 30 years.
However many years, yeah.
So if Florida is that key,
then that
little population ends up having an incredible influence over the rest of us.
Yeah. I want to just tell you one example, and we're closing in here, but I want to say a couple things about what's on the board, but just one example of how things get distorted by the anti-Castro forces in this country. As they were talking about sending Elian back, do you remember hearing over and over again, when kids reach age 7, they don't get any more milk in Cuba? Do you remember hearing that? That was one of the kind of litanies that played out of Miami. Don't send Elian back to this country where they take children's milk away from them at age 7. Let's listen to it another way. In Latin America, Cuba is the only country that guarantees a liter of milk to every child in that country up through age 7. Same fact, how is it presented? Same fact. You go to El Salvador or rural Nicaragua and you say, we'll guarantee milk to your children till age 7. Wow, they don't have that. Same fact, different way that it's presented. What can you do about all of this? I just wanted to point a couple of things out to you here. It really makes a difference when legislators hear from their constituents. It really makes a difference. When I go into a senator's office or a representative's office to talk about Cuba, I ask, what have you been hearing from your constituents? They know. They know how many letters they've gotten. They know what the people are asking for. If they've heard nothing, they say to me, I'm going to have to hear something from my constituents before I can move on this issue. So your letter and your phone call really are important. Call the U.S. Capitol switchboard, which will then give you to your representative or your senator, here's the number. To call the White House, here's the number, and you leave a voicemail message. To write to your senator, basically the only thing you need to know here is the zip code, because it's just House of the Senate, Washington, D.C., House of Representatives, D.C., with the zip code. I would encourage you, if the issue of Cuba holds some interest for you, give a call or write a letter to your senator, senators or representative, and do it quickly, because things are going to happen very quickly in the next few weeks. This whole food and medicine issue is going to be a done deal. Yes.
Also, making a call to the Capitol switchboard, you can ask your senator's office to switch you to the other senator and then to your representative. So it could be only one.
Just one call. That's,
now, you're saying that these bills, even as bad as they are, ought to be passed.
What I would say, and what I have been saying when I talk to people, is allow for the sale of food and medicine without licensing. Don't tighten travel restrictions. Don't take that out of the president's hand. Those two things right away. Now, what that does is, in essence, says the Nethercutt bill isn't good. And that's a hard thing to say, because there are a few good things in it, and it is a foot in the door. But the travel issue is really, it's really a big issue. It gives the president no leeway from November 7th, when he's, you know, a lame duck, through the inauguration of the new president in January. That's a wonderful period for a president to do some pretty risky things, because he hasn't got anything to lose. The election's all, it's a done deal. And oftentimes that's the time when a president can make some pretty surprising moves. And people were hoping for that regarding Cuba during Clinton's lame duck time. If this piece of legislation passes, that kind of takes that out of his hands. So I just encourage you to be in touch with your congresspeople. Tell them, don't use food and medicine as a weapon. It's a humanitarian issue. I think for people of faith, it's a faith issue, that you don't deprive people who choose somewhat differently than we choose of medicine and food. Any other questions?
Do you have a list of where different
people are at? I do. If anybody wants to know how your own representative or senators have voted or what their positions are, I can look that up for you. Definitely. And sign up if you're interested in getting updates on this kind of information. Thanks very much.
Yes.